Les conférences du Collège de France.
Bonsoir à toutes et à tous. Donc c'est un plaisir de vous retrouver pour la dernière conférence de Steve Quake, qui vient de Stanford University, et donc qui a donné deux cours au mois de juin, il y a 15 jours. Et donc pour la dernière de ces cours, Steve Quake nous parlera de Medical Innovation from the Genome Revolution, Liquid Biopsies. So this shows the breadth of Steve Quake's work, which goes from fundamental conceptual aspects of living matter, living organisms, to immunology, as we heard last time, and evolution, and now sort of the medical implication of his work. So thanks, Steve, for coming. We look forward to your next and last talk.
Thank you, Thomas. It's terrific to be back here. And as you mentioned, this talk will be a little different than the others in this series. It's still about mysteries of the cell, but in this case, what happens when things go wrong in cells and disease, and how can you detect and measure that, especially when you may not have access to the cells. And so we're going to talk about how to diagnose a variety of different disorders of the cell and diseases using what are called liquid biopsies, which is to say blood tests, and how we can use signals in the blood to measure things that are going on deep in the body. And the whole talk is going to depend on using sort of one interesting physiological discovery, which was made in Strasbourg in 1948 by Paul Mendel and Pierre Matthijs. And they discover the phenomenon of circulating cell-free DNA and RNA. We call it circulating cell-free nucleic acids. And this is sort of an amazing phenomenon that has had many practical applications in the years since. What happens is, when your cells die, they break open, their contents are spilled into the blood, and the molecules within go into the blood, including the genome, the DNA, which gets chewed up into little pieces, and including the RNA. And sometimes RNA is exported from cells into the blood as well, from living cells. So there's DNA and RNA in the blood from basically every organ and tissue in your body, every cell type contributes. And there's potentially a lot of information there. And this was sort of an amazing discovery. 1948, Oswald Avery had just like the year before proved that DNA was the molecule of inheritance. And very few people had read that work, even fewer believed it. Mendel and Matthijs were just doing blood chemistry, and they made this amazing discovery, which has had many, many practical applications. This paper was lost for a long time. It was sort of mentioned only in a very obscure review article. This is not the Comte Rondeau you know. This is a more obscure version of Comte Rondeau. I had to persuade a friend in Paris to scan it from a library physically from the paper and send it to me. And when I read the paper, I noticed this amusing line here. They're talking about the study, and I'll get to the data a little later, with various afflictions. We've also seen something very interesting in the case of leukemia and cancer, which we're going to save for another publication. So even back in 1948, people were splitting results across papers. And I've never found that second paper. I feel like I should go to the library in Strasbourg and look for it, because I'm sure it's very interesting. So the first example we're going to talk about, and we're going to talk about a number of different sort of diverse pathologies and diseases today. The first one has to do with the most common genetic disorder for live births, for babies. And it's what happens when you get an extra chromosome. Sometimes when the cells divide, the chromosomes don't segregate properly, you get a cell with an extra copy. We're supposed to have two copies of every chromosome, plus our sex chromosomes. You can actually see pictures. It's called a karyotype. Here you go. People line them up. Chromosomes 1, 2, 3, 4. They've all got numbers. Right here, chromosome 21, there's three copies. Okay, that's called aneuploidy, or having the wrong number of chromosomes. Having three copies of 21 is called Down syndrome, and that's the most common. It affects about 0.5%, almost 1% of live births in aggregate. And there's been techniques to measure that, but they involve invasive techniques during pregnancy, where a needle is put inside the mom's belly, either for amniocentesis or chronic villus sampling, and that invasive procedure itself has risk for the fetus and for the mom. And in fact, miscarriage rates are comparable to actually the rates of occurrence of the disease, which is crazy. And so I got interested in this when I first became a father, and we had this procedure done, and I'm thinking, why are we risking our unborn daughter's life for the sake of a diagnostic test? That didn't make a lot of sense, and I began thinking about, were there ways to do non-invasive measurements that would give you genetic information. And eventually I ran across the discovery of cell-free DNA in Mendel and Matthijs and realized that may be the route to it. And if you look at the actual data in their paper, here it is. These are all the sort of subjects. There's the amount of DNA and RNA that they measured. You can see a bunch of normal people, goit, diabetes, cirrhosis, so forth, gout, and pregnancy. And they noted in the case of pregnancy, it was different. The value seemed higher. And what was going on with that? The ultimate mystery, the solution to that mystery, awaited the development of molecular biology. And, you know, sort of a half century later, Jim Wainscott's group in Oxford used what the then invented molecular biology techniques of PCR to show that some of that extra DNA in pregnancy came from the fetus. And they did that with a very clever experiment. They looked for the male sex chromosome, which should not be present in the female body, unless female is pregnant with a male fetus, and that fetus is contributing some DNA into the blood. And they were able to show they could amplify the Y chromosome DNA in the case of women pregnant with male fetuses. And the student first trainee on that paper is Dennis Lowe, who's going on to a very distinguished career in the field as well. So that set off like a long effort to try to find ways to use the presence of this fetal DNA to say something about the genetics of the baby. And many different things were tried, none of which worked. People tried to look for biochemical methods to enrich for fetal DNA versus maternal, and there were no differences found. In aneuploidy, there's no mutations to look for. It's just an extra copy of a chromosome. So it was a very interesting challenge. And part of the reason why it's a hard measurement is the fetal DNA makes up only a small fraction of the cell-free DNA, order of 1% or less. So you're trying to measure a very small difference in a small amount of DNA. And eventually at Stanford, we figured out how to do that. And the idea is a very simple one from statistics. Let's call it the counting principle. The idea is that there should be, in the case of an aneuploid chromosome, a slight overrepresentation of DNA from that chromosome. And you can see it sort of schematically here, where the maternal DNA has been schematically covered black, the fetal red. And if the mom is normal, you have two copies coming from every control chromosome, including chromosome 21. If the baby has Down syndrome, it's putting in three copies of 21 for every two copies of the other chromosomes. And so if you count up molecules from chromosome 21 versus, say, chromosome 1, and look at that ratio, if it's different than 1, you can infer that chromosome 21 may be aneuploid. And how do you get enough sensitivity and precision to do that? Well, you can measure very small differences if you count enough molecules. Your error in making that measurement goes like 1/√ of the number of molecules you count, just from simple statistics. And so you can measure as small a difference as you want simply by counting high enough. You just need to count enough molecules. And this has a very unusual property for a diagnostic. It's limited only by how high you want to count, not by any fundamental aspects of the reagent sensitivity or specificity. That's the theory. We demonstrated in principle by counting with a next generation sequencer. This was the work of a terrific student in my lab, Christina Fan, and our clinical collaborators, Yair Blumenfeld. We ran a small study at Stanford, had blood from pregnant women, some of whom had fetuses with Down syndrome or trisomy 21. Christina purified the cell-free DNA. We sequenced it. Every sequence read was mapped back to the reference human genome and allowed to vote for a chromosome, and we just looked for overrepresentation. And here you can see is the relative amount of chromosome 21 DNA relative to chromosome 1. The blue data points are from the moms who had normal fetuses, the red from the ones who had fetuses with Down syndrome, but you can see very clear overrepresentation. So it works just the way the theory said it would. So math works. Now, of course, in this measurement, there's nothing special about chromosome 21. We can ask the same question of every chromosome. So we did that, and that's what it looks like here. Here's the chromosomes in an order of GC content. This is 21 right here. We had two women in the study with fetuses with trisomy 18. That's those two outliers right there. One with a fetus with trisomy 13, it's that outlier. Those are the three major aneuploidies that one finds in human genetics. And so this sort of in principle unlocked the solution to this. We published the paper in 2008, and it attracted a lot of attention. A number of clinical trials were launched, including thousands of women. And within 3 or 4 years, the first commercial versions of these tests were launched. Not surprisingly, pregnant women did not like getting amniocentesis and having invasive tests, and there was just enormous interest in blood tests. And the uptake was tremendous. Within the first year of launching, 500,000 women were using it, then 1 million, then 3 million. Now more than 8 million women a year are getting some version of what's been called now non-invasive prenatal testing. And as you might think, as the use of the test has gone up with time, the use of invasive tests like amniocentesis has declined precipitously. People just didn't want to take the risk and don't take the risk anymore. And so that's just been sort of an amazing trajectory to see. While the clinical work was going on, in my lab we were interested in more fundamental questions, and we began to ask, how else could we apply the counting principle? And what other genetic differences could we measure? There's other structural variations that happen, such as deletions, that cause a variety of genetic diseases. Many of these are de novo, they're not inherited. And we began to look for some of those. For example, DeGeorge syndrome, which is a 3 megabase deletion, most of which is de novo. And we happen to have a woman come through our study who was pregnant with a fetus who had DeGeorge syndrome. So we got that blood sample and we went and sequenced it. And we decided to now use windows. Instead of letting every sequence read vote for one chromosome, we let it vote for a window along the chromosome. And that's sort of what you see here. Okay, so here's each of the chromosomes. We've got windows. You can see the representation is pretty good. Around the centromeres, it's just that's a genome mapping issue. Down here at chromosome 22, you see this big dip right here. That's exactly the locus of DeGeorge syndrome. And sure enough, you can see the reads there drop right at the right place, including the key gene. The Z-scores, the statistical metrics go way up. And it was sort of clear that we could detect it. So it's not just a matter of being able to detect changes in chromosome number. You can detect other alterations of the genome, large chunks that are deleted or copied. And then the question becomes, how small can you make that window? And how small of a change can you measure in the genome? And if you make that window smaller and smaller, can you get down to the individual base pair level and measure individual mutations and polymorphisms? So we decided to do that. And again, purified the cell-free DNA, did an exome pull down, sequenced the exome. Those are just the coding parts of the genome, and then measure the polymorphisms there. And we're able to show that we could measure pretty much any mutation we wanted in any gene in the genome. This is the work of Wei Gu, and this sort of shows a summary of the data. I won't go through it in enormous detail, but this sort of shows the receiver operator curves for sort of type of mutation. There's 4 broad kinds. The math or the counting principle is a little different for each one, but this shift here represents the fraction of cell-free, fraction of fetal DNA in the sample from not represented to a novel allele, or if there's a heterozygous allele, this is if it's changed. So that sort of put a bookend on this sort of thing for me, in the sense that, in principle, you could measure any genetic question you have about the fetus before it was born, and we'll see where it all ends up. By far, the most widely used version of this has been the aneuploidies, but one can ask any question one wants. What came next for us after we published the first paper was I got a call from my colleague Hannah Valentine in cardiology, and she said, "Steve, we have this problem with our heart transplant patients that after we do the transplant, we go and physically biopsy the heart to see if it's rejecting. And after going through all the trouble to put a new heart in these people, we're going in and taking out pieces of tissue, and it's painful, and there's other reasons we don't like to do it. And so is there a way to do what you did for pregnancy for transplant?" And I thought about it a bit, and I realized that the heart transplant is really a genome transplant. What I mean by that is every cell in that heart has a different genome than every other cell in the recipient's body, because the heart comes from another person. So before the transplant, all the cell-free DNA in the individual and the recipient is, let's call it, red. They have a red genome. It comes from their genome. Now they get a heart from a person who has a green genome. As cells from the heart die, those green genome molecules get in the blood, and now you've got a mixture of red and green. If that person's immune system starts to attack the heart, and that's what rejection is, then more cells will die. There should be more green DNA in the blood. That was the basic idea and principle. And so we decided to try to test that. And my then postdoc, Tim Snyder, did the work. That's Hannah there. And we used samples that Hannah had collected over the years in the freezer and sequenced them. In this case, not trying to count for given chromosomes, but counting polymorphisms that were different between the donor and the recipient. And so we can look at the number of the amount of donor DNA by looking at polymorphisms. And each of these is a different patient. Every point here is a different point in time after transplant when the person had a blood sample drawn and had an invasive biopsy done. And the red arrows are the places where the pathologist looked at the biopsies and said there was a rejection event. So you can see the cell-free DNA really closely tracks it. It peaks up at the rejection events. It stays flat when there's none. And in some cases, it's starting to increase even before the pathologist calls the rejection. So we did this on a very small number of samples, and but this kind of proved the principle. And again, the thing that was so pleasing about this is that it's a universal approach. It doesn't depend on any particular physiology of the heart. You could use it for any transplanted organ you wanted. So we then launched a large-scale study and at Stanford recruited sort of every heart transplant recipient over the next 3 years. And Kieran Kush took that over at one point. Ewan Devlamick was a postdoc in my lab doing the wet work. And we were able to show a very good receiver-operator curve. This is the false positive versus true positive rate. And the closer this area under this gets to one, the better the test is. So this was 0.95. at its highest point. So we were comparing it to biopsy, and yet biopsy is an imperfect measure. So it's known that two different pathologists looking at the same heart biopsy will only agree 70% of the time. So there's a challenge for how you sort of compare any new technology to an old one that's imperfect. In this case, we looked at places where there was disagreement between our result and biopsy and used other methods to try to referee it, including using the medical record, the fact that we had longitudinal data and such forth, and virtually every disagreement resolved in our favor. We did the same thing with lung and lung transplantation, and this pulmonologists here, Dave Weil, Mark Nichols, Dave Cornfield, and again, very good sort of agreement with sort of rejection calling by the doctors, and also interesting correlations with other measurements of lung dysfunction. Whenever physiological things were going on with the lung, we were seeing more lung DNA in the blood. So those together, those three works kind of proved the principle of this for transplant. And this got licensed by a company called CareDx. They got Medicare reimbursement. They launched a product. And it's been doing very well, and it's really transformed care. It's used in more than 345 transplant centers in the U.S., 17 here in Europe, 4 in Asia. Something like 80% of heart transplant patients get a version of this test every year now in the U.S., half of kidney transplant and nearly half of lung transplant. So it's really had enormous impact, more than 100,000 tests a year. When we were doing this work, my postdoc, Ewan, who I mentioned a moment earlier, came to me one day and he said, you know, when I map the reads, the sequence reads, to the human genome, something like 98% of them map to the human genome. And I said, Ewan, that's great. That means you're doing a good job. There's not a lot of contamination. It's great. Let's focus on this transplant thing. And fortunately, he didn't listen to me. He got very interested in what's that 2% that doesn't map to the human genome. And he dug into that, and he discovered that that 2% was not contamination. It was real DNA from these individuals, and it was DNA from their microbiomes, the bacteria and viruses that are in all our bodies and colonize them. And so we realized we had a very interesting way to study the human microbiome through these blood samples. And you can see a great diversity of viruses, many different kinds of viruses, bacteria, and such forth. We have it sort of by different degrees of phylogenetic specificity shown here. Broadly speaking, for the next part, I just want to focus on four classes of viruses. Herpes viruses, these are ones that are very clinically important because they can cause rejection and patients are given antivirals to try to prevent that. Polyoma viruses, which cause cancer, and organ transplant patients have increased cancer rates in part because they're on immunosuppressant drugs. Adenoviruses, which cause respiratory infections, and anelaviruses, which are mysterious viruses that are ubiquitous, not really associated with any disease, but as you'll see, play an important role in the story. So Here's what you see as far as the viral distribution between those four families as a function of two variables. One variable is antiviral drugs, which are meant to handle the herpes viruses. The other are the level of immunosuppressant. All these patients have to take drugs to suppress their immune system because that's how the doctors try to prevent rejection. And the more immunosuppressant you give, the less chance of rejection, but concomitantly, the worse the immune system works, so the higher the chance of infection. So the doctors try to dial in the level of immunosuppressant drugs very carefully to get that balance between preventing rejection and yet not having too much infection. And so it's measured and very carefully tracked in all the patients. And so you can see the healthy patients or the ones right after the transplant look like this. And then as you increase immunosuppression or increase antivirals, in both cases, the orange takes over the pie chart. The orange, remember, are these Annela viruses. They are the ones that are sort of in the most intimate dance with the immune system, and they can be thought of as perhaps a proxy of immune system strength, because when you start turning down the immune system, they fill in. Or if you take out other viruses, like the herpeviruses, the Annela viruses fill in. You can see that both in a relative sense here and in sort of an absolute sense here now. This is time post-transplant, and the Annela virus load here tracks both the use of immunosuppressant as it's cranked up, and then as the immunosuppressant drug gets tapered over time, they go down again. Whereas with bacteria, much less dynamic. It's just steady. It's not affected by the antiviral drugs, which you might expect, and nor is it affected by the immunosuppressants. And here it is again in absolute terms. So we realized this would be a very powerful way to study infectious disease. And infectious disease is a substantial problem, even in the developed world. And it's not unusual for people to have some sort of infection which is not correctly diagnosed. The numbers in the U.S., something like 1 million people a year face an unresolved infectious disease diagnosis. And so that's a challenge. And the overall disease burden is substantial of infectious disease. So we realized that we could use this approach of sequencing cell-free DNA as kind of a hypothesis-free infectious disease test and founded a company called Carius to develop it. They have now created a test which gets turned around very quickly within 1 day of receiving the sample, and it tests effectively for more than 1,000 different microorganisms all at once. And that company was founded by a former postdoc of mine, Mickey Cortez, and it's now been put through a variety of clinical trials. It's been really remarkable. Here's one such publication where the people using it compared it to blood culture and PCR and found sort of much higher rates of diagnosis using cell-free DNA than conventional methods. Here's another one done by Chuck Gawad, who's a pediatric oncologist. Turns out when you have blood cancer, well, your immune system is impacted, so infectious disease is a huge risk. He works with children who have cancer, and he found with sort of high-density blood samples that this cell-free DNA was finding the infection a couple days before any other method with high prediction. And there's now many, many other such studies, and there's been more than 100,000 patients who received a version of this test, and it's been remarkable. And the amazing thing about infectious disease is it can often be cured if you know what you're treating. And so with these patients, many of them have been struggling for some time. Once the correct pathogen is identified, it can be addressed, and they do very well. And the stories are just really remarkable and heartwarming and inspiring. So the examples I've discussed up to this point are cases when there's a different genome in your body, either because there's a fetus in the body with a different genome, or because you've received an organ from somebody else with a different genome, or because it's a microorganism, which is different than your genome. And so those are very special cases of disease. And not every disease is associated with a different genome. And so the next chapter I'm going to talk about in this work is not using DNA, but using RNA. And Mandel Matthijs discovered not just cell-free DNA, but also cell-free RNA. And while a small community of researchers grew up around using cell-free DNA, people forgot about the RNA. And, you know, it was kind of not developed at all as a field. And I became interested in whether you could use this cell-free RNA to study human development. and look at the gene expression programs of humans in utero. This is a beautiful little cartoon, a schematic that someone put together of how we imagine human development happening. And I wondered if it was possible to use cell-free RNA to see that from the fetus in the mom's blood, same way we use the DNA, but in this case, to track the changes that happen during development. And so we did that and used both sort of microarrays and sequencing RNA-seq to look at three different time points during pregnancy, one for each trimester, one postpartum, and discovered that, yes, we could see genes not just from the placenta, but also from the fetus. And you can see interesting things that change in pregnancy according to how we know what happens at different developmental time points. And that gave us kind of the inspiration to now try to do this at high resolution. And we began collaborating with Mads Melby from Copenhagen, whose group recruited a cohort of very brave Danish women who agreed to give blood every week during pregnancy. And so each row here is a different volunteer in the study, and each symbol here is a point when they gave blood, and the triangles are when they gave birth. This was an amazing, amazing cohort. And we analyzed this in a couple of different ways. One way that I'll just talk about is using qPCR to look at gene expression for a panel of genes and looking at how those change with time during pregnancy. And in this panel, we chose some genes from the mother's genome and the placenta and other tissues, some from the immune system, some from the fetal, some genes that are only expressed during development by fetuses. And in all cases, you can see they're increasing throughout pregnancy and then go away afterwards, as you might expect. Okay. And this allowed us to build a clock of sorts so we could look at any of these measurements and work out how far and along in development the fetus was and use this for gestational aging. And that's an interesting application. It's generally done by ultrasound, but not everybody gets it, and ultrasound's not always available in the developing world. And many interesting applications of this in the developing world. But one that we decided to focus on is not so much gestational age, but predicting when delivery was going to happen. Because it turns out that preterm birth in both the developed and the developing world is a major problem. It's the leading cause of neonatal death and complications later in life. It affects almost 10% of pregnancies, and there's no meaningful diagnostic to understand who's at risk. This is my daughter. In the first day of her life, that is day one of her life, she was born preterm a month early. We went through that. It's a sort of massive widespread issue. So we decided to try to use cell-free RNA as a tool to predict when the clock might be going off early for delivery. And with David Stevenson, Gary Shaw at Stanford, who are running a preterm center, they connected us with collaborators who had collected very interesting cohorts, including Mikhail Elovitz from Penn and Joe Biggio from University of Alabama, who had people delivering very early. Okay, so these, remember, this is normal, this is preterm, this is normal, these are preterm. And we analyzed the cell-free RNA from these studies as well as the one from Copenhagen. In this case, Tui Ngo, who's a postdoc in the lab, Mira Mufarej, who's a student, and Joan Comunas, who was a postdoc, and found a set of genes that were really differentially expressed between preterm birth and normal delivery, term delivery. These are the genes right here. The green cohorts are, the green are the members of the cohorts who had full-term delivery. The blue are the ones that had preterm. So in two different cohorts with preterm and three cohorts with normal, you can see really repeatable results here. And it was not a lot of individuals, but happily we could do in different cohorts. We were able to show that we could build sort of a classifier and predict reasonably accurately who was going to have spontaneous preterm birth as early as 2 months in advance of delivery. So this was a far thing from a diagnostic. It was just sort of the barest proof of principle. There was a lot to do. These cohorts were very small, ethnically homogeneous, and many other issues had to be sorted out. And in the time that passed since then, we've started to sort that out, both in my lab and in a company called MIRV that we founded, and decided to focus on preeclampsia, which is a hypertensive disorder that's a major contributor to preterm birth. And began to look at that in larger cohorts that were more ethnically diverse. And the work we did, we published papers at the same time. The Stanford work, it was a couple hundred members. Here, more than 1,000 at the company. And we're able to show that cell-free RNA worked in large cohorts, in ethnically diverse cohorts, and it was very informative as to what was going on, and particularly to the different cell types of the mom's body as hypertension was happening. We can infer a lot of information. And so the company then went and did a large prospective study where they were blinded. People were recruited, nearly 10,000 women. That was published earlier this year, and it worked amazingly well. So they have now launched the first real molecular test for preeclampsia. And you can see sort of what the impact is. Again, without really having any molecular diagnostic for who's at risk, using only sort of maternal risk factors such as age and weight and ethnicity and such forth, like a vast majority of pregnancies are said, you're moderate risk, you should take aspirin. The relative risk is very small, 1.1. And who listens to that? Like only 10%. Because it's not very specific. In contrast, with the molecular test, you can really partition that group into low risk and high risk with a much larger relative risk of 5.5. And the early data from that is showing that when you tell people you're high risk based on a molecular test, almost 3/4 of them will take the aspirin. They're much more compliant and willing to do that. So this has been, I think, a really remarkable outcome, and the test is just starting to get out there, and over the next few years, I'm hoping it will become very widely used and provide a lot of health benefit. So the last thing I'm going to talk about is cancer, this has been a field where I would say cell-free DNA has been applied for the longest. People appreciated very early on that the tumor genome is different than the normal genome of an individual. They started to find ways to try to look for mutations in the cell-free DNA that would indicate presence of a tumor. There's a lot of beautiful academic work on this over the years. The first tests took a long time to come out. In fact, they came out after the NIPT tests. But now there's several tests on the market that use cell-free DNA to look at mutations and other effects to try to detect cancer. And what I think the community has realized is this can be an amazing way to cure cancer. And the insight is the following, that if cancer is detected early, before it spreads, it can be removed surgically. And that leads to very high survival rates. The drugs that are used for cancer, they're very toxic. They work sometimes, but not for everybody. And the later the cancer is, the less effective the drugs are, and the survival rates are concomitantly lower. And so this sort of shows the overall statistics. If you detect early in situ, the survival rate is almost 100%. You cut out a localized mass, you're done. If it's localized but starting to spread, still very good. If it's in the region, it gets worse. Metastatic, it's really bad. So this is a case where the diagnostic actually can be more effective than a therapeutic if it enables surgery early enough. So that's the idea. If you look at cancer deaths and which types of cancer are the most lethal, it sort of looks like this. This is the pie chart. For these four, colorectal, prostate, lung, and breast, there are tests that are used to screen for early detection. And so there are existing tests, and there's opportunities to improve those methods and have them work earlier. For this piece of the pie, pancreas, liver, bladder, kidney, stomach, ovary, blood, esophagus, there's no existing test. So here's a place where new tests could potentially save a lot of lives and really expand the fraction of the pie that you could do for early detection. And this is really what my work has focused on. And in keeping with the theme of trying to understand the mysteries of the cell, we focused not so much on looking for mutations associated with the tumor, but looking for other changes to the genome, so-called epigenetic changes that really reflect the changes in cell biology as the tumor grows and de-differentiates, because we have this hypothesis that it would be most powerful and informative to be able to measure the cell biology rather than the genome changes, and that would provide not only exquisite sensitivity, but also specificity about where in the body the tumor was. So let me digress for a moment onto some basic background on epigenetics. So we In the field, there's something people call the fifth base. Remember the four bases, A, C, T, G, chemically different. Those are the alphabet that make up the genome. People talk about a fifth base, which is actually a modification of cytosine. So C, cytosine, is shown here. Sometimes there's a methyl group added there, okay? And that's a signal used inside the cell to tell the cell, don't use this gene. If you put methyl there, transcriptional sites get blocked. That gene can't be expressed. It's a way to turn off genes. It's used very widely around the body. It's a very sort of chemically interesting phenomenon as well. So if the C is unmethylated, the chemical structure looks like this. There's enzymes called DNA methyltransferases that can add the methyl to it, which will turn off the gene when that section of the genome is methylated. But then sometimes the cell wants to turn the gene back on, so it needs to be demethylated. And how does that happen? Well, a number of groups in the chemistry community worked on that for more than a decade, and the story is now pretty well understood, and it's complicated and interesting. First thing that happens is enzymes called TET are used to change the methyl to hydroxymethyl, and then there's several other chemical intermediates made by the same enzymes until finally the base is back to unmethylated. Now, the thing that we decided to focus on is this intermediate right here, hydroxymethyl, HMC, hydroxymethylcytosine. It's the first intermediate, it's the most long-lived, and therefore the most important and most informative for making chemical measurements, of making epigenetic measurements. And we developed in my lab a way to do that using cell-free DNA, in cell-free DNA, so that we could measure which parts of cell-free DNA were hydroxymethylated, which were not. And that provided a window into gene expression changes, because understanding which genes are hydroxymethylated is the same as understanding which genes are being turned back on. As the cell is moving to a different state and sort of de-differentiating, becoming the tumor becomes de-differentiated, and those changes result in genes being turned on that are inappropriate because they're early developmental genes. They're not generally expressed anywhere else in the body, and therefore potentially very informative about one's state of health with respect to cancer. So without going into the details of the method, I'll just sort of jump to the results that we published. Each point here is a different individual patient and blood sample. It's color-coded by disease. These are the patients that were healthy. And you can see near the healthy ones, there's some breast cancer and brain cancer. We weren't so good at differentiating those right off the bat. But you can see other cancers further out. This is pancreatic cancer. This is liver cancer. This is lung cancer. And so it does seem to not only discriminate this hydroxymethylation signal, not only who's got cancer and who's healthy, but different cancers occupy different parts of the space. And so that got us excited enough to launch a company and try to do this at scale and in large trials and so forth, and to try to go after some of those unscreened cancers I talked about a moment ago. So the first one we looked at was pancreatic cancer, and this sort of shows you the statistics and benefits of early detection. Pancreatic cancer is known to be particularly lethal. Your chances are not very good if you have it. The reason is it tends to be detected late. 80% of pancreatic cancers are found only after the cancer has spread and become metastatic because there are essentially no symptoms. And so that's why it's lethal. And you can see the survival rate is extremely low. However, you're lucky enough to find it early, your survival chances go up dramatically, and you can have more than order of magnitude improvement in survival if only you could find it early. But there's no tests until now. So ClearNote Health devised a test for early detection of pancreatic cancer. It's the very first one ever. Got breakthrough approval from the FDA, and performs amazingly well. This is a publication showing of the first version of the test, something like 70% sensitivity on early stage cancers. This was enough to kind of launch the test. And it's available now for people to use. And there's particularly high-risk groups, not only those who have family histories of pancreatic cancer, but people who have recent diagnoses of diabetes. Diabetes is very highly correlated with increased risk for pancreatic cancer. And that's a group for which this test is first being deployed. We're very excited to see that. Another important unscreened cancer is ovarian cancer, and you can see the same sort of statistics here. It's generally not diagnosed until it's become distant, and more than half the time it's diagnosed after distant, and then the survival rate is not great. Whereas if you can find it early when it's localized, and very few ovarian cancers are diagnosed then, you would have amazing survival rates, increase of 30%, almost everybody would survive. So again, if there were a test for early ovarian cancer, the benefits would be enormous. And so ClearNote built a version of that across all stages of ovarian cancer. Sensitivity approached 80%, the specificity of 94%. And you can see what that means for early detection, where the sensitivity is about 63%. Currently, only this fraction gets detected early. With this test, we think it could be this fraction. That could help a lot of people and save a lot of lives. We're very excited about that. And this is the second test they've launched from the company. So those are two very specific examples where they've gone in and done a very deep dive. And what about the rest of them? And so there's been sort of a strong effort in the oncology world to develop what's called now multi-cancer early detection. And the National Cancer Institute in the U.S. had run a competition among all the commercial outfits that were offering multi-cancer tests and chose two winners, one of which is ClearNote's test. And so they're now engaged on a very interesting trial with the National Cancer Institute to try to validate the test on a large cohort. But the preliminary result that got them there is shown here. So these eight cancers here represent roughly 2/3 of cancer mortality. And so about 2/3 of mortality comes from only eight cancers. A couple of them have existing tests, but most of them do not. Okay, and if you ask how, so ClearNote did a study here, built a trainer, again, over a couple thousand patients, 1,000 cancer, 1,000 non-cancer, half of the cancers were early stage. Overall, sensitivity is around 60%, and you can see how it is for each of the individual cancers. So now, besides ovarian and pancreatic I've talked about, which have been unscreened, we have something for liver, esophagus, gastric cancer. How do you measure sensitivity? So you look at, you train on a subset of the data, test on held out data, and look on the held out, which fraction of actuals you were able to detect versus ones you couldn't. And so with that, I'll kind of summarize by saying, I hope I've given you a taste of how simple blood tests, which can be performed anywhere, are saving lives in very diverse areas of human health, ranging from pregnancy, maternal health, cancer, infectious disease, organ transplantation. These replace invasive biopsies, which require the presence of a skilled physician. And so I think it's an amazing contribution to health equity because there are many parts of the world, even parts of the U.S., rural parts of the U.S., where you don't have physicians or medical centers who can do these biopsies, but everywhere you have places that can draw blood. It can be put in the mail, sent for testing, and that provides the benefits of these tests to a much broader part of the population. That's my daughter. I showed you her picture on the first day of her life. This is somewhere around the 20th year of her life. It all worked out fine for her, and for that, I'm very grateful. I'll stop here and take any further questions. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.